Well, good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But we ask you to hold your calls for the time being. We have with us on the line Patrick Murphy, who's one of our supporters, but also somebody we've gotten to know through the years. Very concerned about what's going on. He called me about 2 weeks ago after having just reread George Orwell's 1984 and pointed out that what Orwell wrote about is just what's going on in the world today. Three major blocks in the world. And, of course, each one of those blocks was a dictatorship over their people, and that's exactly what the master plan of the internationalists is. The European bloc, the Western Hemisphere, and that's what NAFTA, what the Free Trade Zone of Central America, the Free Trade Zone of the Americas really is all about. What we still do is we start out simply by tearing down the trade barriers. That's all it's about. Nothing more than simply so we can export more goods and improve the living standards of the average American. And, of course, it's a lie. They always lie to us. They say one thing when they have another objective. Their real effort is to simply impoverish the American people as we transfer our jobs throughout the rest of the Western Hemisphere. And then, of course, we'll have to have some sort of a central currency because, of course, there'll be so much chaos. And then, of course, we'll have a government. And they'll do the same thing in Asia. And then they could move all of these areas together. Maybe there'll even be a fifth area in Africa. Who knows? But all of these things are developing, and they're developing very rapidly. And I think we can go back to what George Orwell wrote about in when he wrote his book. It was in the late 1940s, 1984. With that as a background, Patrick, thank you so much for being with us.
Hi, Dr. Stan. I agree with everything that you just said, but there's an additional element that the thing that really inspired me to call you was this insight I got into the book, which had to do with doublethink. Which, you know, it seems like the central idea that that Orwell has sort of explicated in that wonderful book of his.
All right, fine. Well, why don't you explain to our listeners what is doublethink?
Well, it's an idea that I think suffuses our culture, and it explains to a big degree what our problem is when we try and get across the ideas that you, in fact, that your entire ministry to the world, why it's so difficult for people to accept it. And here's the idea, that somehow a person can be aware of an idea, of a truth, and deny it in order to be accepted in the world, in order to become acceptable. So, for instance, you alluded to NAFTA and GATT and how, you know, damaging. Well, you can be aware that NAFTA and GATT are genuinely terrible, just terrible. They're stripping away the industrial infrastructure of America. And at the same time go on pretending it's not true. But not even pretending. I think that doublethink enables you, well, if you're successful, the more successful you get at practicing it, you can almost, even though you know it's true, you push it out of your mind. And so, in other words, ultimately, you'll never pass Rush Limbaugh's kook test. You know, he has this Rush Limbaugh, if you've listened over the years. occasionally he'll give this kook test, which is, do you believe that the Council on Foreign Relations controls, you know, the blah blah? And he makes you sound like a wacko, like a fool. I think that doublethink, I mean, and we could get into this in more detail, but just to summarize it and make it glib and on the surface, say that doublethink is a technique of knowing the truth about the world and not failing or passing, however you want to describe it, Rush Limbaugh's kook test.
So, well, you know, I think that, you know, as you go back, and I haven't read the book for, I don't know, 20 or 30 years, but as I remember, Winston Smith is agonizing over just what you're talking about. Winston Smith, for those of you who haven't read the book, and if you haven't, shame on you, you need to get it and read it. Winston Smith is trying to say, well, you know, there are eternal truths. Two and two is four, and you can't change that. Well, of course, they're changing that in our schools today. They have the constructive math, the fuzzy math, and it's really not whether two and two is four, but how do you feel about two and two? How do you feel about mathematics? How do you feel about geometry and all of these things? And, well, instead of studying mathematics, we'll talk about death education, or we'll talk about suicide education, because after all, if two people commit suicide and two more commit suicide, that's four, or, and it has nothing to do with anything. But what they're doing is dumbing down our children. But I think the thing that I remember most was Winston Smith said, if you hold up two fingers, you will see two fingers. You won't see three fingers. And, you know, so there are eternal truths. There are things that are absolute, and you can't change it. Wasn't that more or less what he was saying?
Yes. The book itself, the way it's structured, is the awakening of an individual to what has been done to us, and as it opens up, he has actually spent 7 years coming to grips with the fact that he doesn't believe the lie that has been that the whole system is telling. This is Winston Smith, the character of the book, the protagonist. And by the end, what you're describing, that's when he's been trapped and caught by the system, and he's being brainwashed, and he has to come face to face with, what do I believe? And I believe that 2 plus 2 equals 4, and the system can't tell me that 2 plus 2 equals 5, and therefore, that's when this really comes out, this, you know, how can they do this to the mind of a person? And he has been struggling with this for a long time. So the book is, in a sense, an awakening. And I read a biography of Orwell over the last month, and it's clear that this is, in a way, his own story. Orwell was always an honest broker of ideas his whole life, but it took him a long time to come to the point where he was truly terrified of what had been done. I think that what we're facing is a culture that Orwell genuinely was afraid had already happened in 1948, and he just transposed the two numerals. When he titled it 1984, it was really 1948. And this was just a little bit after he died. I mean, the book was written in 46. So it was just, he was saying this is today. That was then. But his fear was that they could get away with this now, convincing us that the 2 plus 2 equals 5.
Well, why don't you give us a history of George Orwell? Who was he? He was really a key player in this whole move to create a world fascist society. He was a Fabian socialist. He was certainly hobnob with the elite, who really understood that their goal was to create this world government under the control of a ruling elite represented by Big Brother. But, of course, when he entered this whole movement, I'm sure he was young and idealistic, and wouldn't it be better if we could just create this utopian world without ever realizing the forces that were behind this movement, the dark and sinister spiritual forces that were energizing the people who were trying to bring about the one world dictatorship under their control. And even though many of the men who were dedicated to this and have been down through the centuries knew, realized they would never live to see it come to pass, this was their obsession, this was their goal. Cecil Rhodes, one of the major characters behind this, who created the secret society that became the Council on Foreign Relations, who created the Rhodes Scholarships, Cecil Rhodes, before he died in 1902, said, "It'll take 100 years before this comes to pass, but it will come to pass." And, of course, he then dedicated his great fortune to creating the Rhodes Scholarships, to backing the secret society that became the Council on Foreign Relations, which is America's invisible government today. So let's go into the background of George Orwell. What about his history? What did you learn from his biography and his ideals, his idealism?
Well, you know, I was a little surprised what I discovered about him. I knew certain things about him already, and the basic outline didn't surprise me. He went to public school, which is private school. I mean, this is England, and it's the early part of the 20th century. You know, it's the old-fashioned. There's still the imperial, the Edwardian life, you know, the memory of the glory, if you want to call it that, of the English Empire, the British Empire.
The sun never set on the English Empire.
Right, exactly.
And England ruled the waves. Today they wave the rules. What was his real name? Because it wasn't George Orwell.
Blair. He changed his name. But one of the reasons he changed his name is because the man was honest all through his life. I don't think he was a sold out person to the, and I agree with everything you just said about the whole sinister backdrop of what was going on. But I found something interesting about him, because I always thought that he is a genuine, wholehearted, world-dominating socialist. But it turns out that what happened was, okay, he went to public school and he went into the public service, to the civil service, and he went to Burma, the East Indies, to be a civil servant. And I remember reading in college, Shooting an Elephant and Burmese Days. And I remember he was very trepidatious. He didn't like anything about the cultural life of the overlords of the British Empire. Well, it turns out that he quit it flat. I mean, he just left it, and no one did this. Once you became a part of the civil service, you basically, that was your life, you know. So he was from the middle class, and he had this great education, and he went into the civil service, and the expectation would be that this is where you would end up. But he left it. Okay. Later, he went slumming. He went into, he wrote a book called Down and Out in Paris and London. He was a dishwasher in sleazy restaurants, and he was basically trying to get a feel for what it was like to be in the lower end of society.
In the lower class of society. He was probably from the middle class or upper middle class.
Then. That's right. And in England, there was a great way to do it, and that's through the civil service, to break free into the upper end, somewhat, you know. And he defied that. Okay, so he ends up swarming in Europe, and then he catches the drift of what's going to happen in Spain in the 30s. And so he goes to fight in the Spanish Civil War. But he makes a very interesting choice. He doesn't join up with the main communist thread. He chooses a separate element, which never was under the sway of the Stalinists. And he sees from the inside what Stalin was doing to this so-called glorious endeavor. The Spanish Civil War was a matter of tremendous import to the left in Europe. But Stalin and what was happening in Russia under Stalin, this was a matter of tremendous divisiveness among the left in Europe. Well, it turns out that Orwell never signed on with that. He was a man of the left. There's no question. He was a socialist his whole life. But he detected what was wrong with what Stalin was doing, and the left never forgave him. To this day, the left still writes nasty things about him because he, even though the left has largely had to agree that Stalin was a monster, to this day they can't forgive him for not being a fellow traveler in those days, even though he was a dedicated socialist. So he's a very interesting character. His eyes were wide open, and he was an honest broker. And I think that this is why 1984 is so important today to us, because what he had to say, and if you look at his book, Animal Farm, they hated him. The left hated him for exposing the Bolshevik Revolution, especially what Stalin did to it. Now, I'm no apologist when I give that caveat. I'm no apologist for Bolshevism. I think Lenin is a monster too. But the point is that the left hates Orwell because he was a Trotskyist. He honestly hated Stalin, which is, to me, I found this to be fascinating to discover that the left really genuinely despises Orwell.
Now, what I think is really so interesting is you look at the Spanish Civil War, and on one side you had the communists, and they were there to overthrow the monarchy, and of course then on the other side you had the people who supported Franco, and there you had the Nazis and the fascists were supporting him. So, but there was nobody there who was really representing this cause of freedom. And what people may not understand, but Nazism was national socialism. Fascism was state socialism or state corporate socialism. They were all left sides. And so you had two left sides fighting one another. One would be for the dictatorship under Franco, which was an anti-communist dictatorship, but it was still a dictatorship. And what people don't understand is that you had a choice sort of between Iraq and a hard place. That's exactly where we are today, Iraq and a hard place. But which side did you want to come down on? The communists were there. They were killing the priests. They were killing the nuns. And they were brutal and tyrannical. And in the war, I'm sure the other side committed atrocities as well. Idealists went from America to fight with the communists against the fascists, and yet they didn't understand that both sides were bad. Neither side espoused the cause of freedom, which we represent here in America, where you have a system where you limit the power of government, where you have a Bill of Rights, which is basically a restrictive covenant that limits what the centralized authority can do. And to this day, it plagues those people who would establish the authoritarian system here in the name of fighting terrorism. That's what the Patriot Act was about, simply chipping away at our constitutional guarantees of freedom. But a lot of people, good people in America, can't see what this is all about. They really believe we're involved in a war on terrorism, and so they support the Patriot Act. After all, it's backed by the Republicans, and we're Republicans, and we believe in what the Republicans stand for, and we stand for traditional family values, and we're against those people on the left, the Democrats, who are criticizing the Patriot Act because it's taking away our freedom. So we have to give up our freedom to fight the nasty terrorists. But, of course, people don't understand the background of this war on terror because they've never read the complete report of the staff report of the 9/11 Commission. All they've heard about is what they read in the newspaper or this sanitized version that is available at your local bookstore. It is not going to tell you anything about what the staff really comes up with, and that is an incredible story. But we don't want to get too far away from George Orwell. Needless to say, the war on terrorism is as phony as a $3 bill. Because if we were really involved in a war on terrorism, our borders would be sealed, every pilot would be armed, there would be marshals on every plane, and they wouldn't be dressed up so that you could spot them 3 miles away, wearing an immaculate suit with a tie and shine shoes. Now they'd be looking like a hippie or something else. Anybody can tell who the marshals are on the planes, and that's part of the plan. We're really not trying to stop hijacking because our leaders know something that the rest of us don't know. We'll be back in just a moment to carry on this concept of what is 1984 really about. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is one of our regular listeners and a loyal supporter, Patrick Murphy. And so we're going to talk about George Orwell. We're going to talk about 1984. And so we're talking about Orwell as an idealistic going to Spain and not necessarily fighting on the side of the Bolsheviks, Stalin's people, but certainly not supporting Franco either, because he's a fascist and the liberals hate the fascists. But the trouble is they don't understand that their liberalism supports fascism. In fact, both fascism and communism and Nazism were all on the side of the total state controlling the individual. So pick up the story there, what you've learned about George Orwell.
Well, what he discovered in that event when he went there and he put his life on the line, and he almost died because the Stalinists had taken over the so-called idealistic cause. They purged everybody. I mean, he witnessed the murder of many of the people who were genuinely trying to fight for what they thought was good, and he almost died. I mean, he got out by the skin of his teeth, and this was indelibly impressed upon him for the rest of his life. His understanding of what communist control would be, he learned it intensely. Okay. Later, after this, he was working for the BBC. Now, there's people. Paul Johnson's wonderful book, I think it's called Modern Times, describes the Spanish Civil War as a dry run for, much like you describe, Dr. Stan, the Boer War as a dry run for the First World War. Paul Johnson talks about the Spanish Civil War as a dry run for the World War II, and so he was fully, his eyes were wide open. You can't trust the fascists. You can't trust the communists. He remained an idealist. And the tragedy is, I don't think that he was a Christian. He was an Anglican, and he had lots of the accoutrement that go along with being a Christian. I mean, he had an old-fashioned way of looking at the world. But I don't think that he... I'll bet you he was really an atheist, ultimately. I can't answer that. Okay, that's sort of a side thing. Here's the issue. He leaves the Spanish issue with that whole problem of how do you win? Be a man of the left, be and not be robbed of your idealism by Stalin. Okay, so he's working for the BBC, and also he has this career as a literary critic. So he wrote a wonderful piece or series of pieces about Boys Life type magazines, and he also wrote a lot about American media infiltration into the European mind. So he's writing articles about the way that the modern media, which is just creating this penumbra, this cloud, the whole world is really going to be entering into. I mean, he was very early into this. He could see it. He could see propaganda. And the expertise that was being developed, it was almost like a science, and he could see it early.
Hold that thought right there as we bring our... Well, this is Dr. Stan. With us this evening is Patrick Murphy. We're talking about George Orwell and the evolution of his ideas from a hardline socialist going off to fight in the Spanish Civil War, seeing the reality of communism. Now, you must understand that most socialists... Most of the people who were Fabian socialists, like Orwell had been, were totally behind communism. And they were actually, George Bernard Shaw, Bertrand Russell, other people of that sort, Sidney and Beatrice Webb, Annie Besant, they all saw absolutely nothing wrong with the tyranny of communist Russia. So you have to understand that Orwell was different than the others. He saw how terrible this was. But there were many people here in the United States. They knew how horrible communism was, but they wanted it to succeed. After all, if it succeeded, then man could remake the world. He could create this utopia. Oh, you'd have to eliminate a few people. What was Khrushchev said? You can't make an omelet without breaking eggs. So they justified the horror. They justified the terror. They justified the inhumanity that man was on the way to making a better world. And that quotation from George Bernard Shaw you'll find on the last page of the appendix of his Intelligent Woman's Guide to Communism and Socialism, to Capitalism and Socialism, I'm sorry, where he says, nobody's ever defined socialism. Let me define it for you. When I say socialism, I mean equality of income or nothing. Under socialism, you'll be forcibly fed and housed and clothed, whether you like it or not, and if it's found that you're unworthy of our efforts, it may be necessary to put you to death in a kindly manner, but while you live, you will live well. That is what socialism is all about. Shaw and the other people who praise him and laud him even to this very day believe an elite knows what's best for us common folks. But obviously Orwell was beginning now, in the years leading up to the Second World War, to question what this was all about. And
I would love to, if he had lived long enough, to be able to ask him the question that you just posed. You know, how would he respond to that? Because, you know, to the day he died, he was a dedicated man of the left. I know this is a fact. I mean, he loved the socialist ideal, but he hated every expression of it. So I wonder how, because he was an honest man. This is the difficulty that he faced, and I think this is the great beauty of 1984, and that's why I called you and I said, you know, everybody should really be refocusing on this book, 1984, because that's the culmination of his life's work. He really was, now, if you look at 1984, and we could get back to the sequence of events that led up to it, but to jump ahead to the end before we get there, I will say this. He, in that book, it's an atheistic book. There is no Jesus Christ. There is no hope. Really. Ultimately, there's no hope in it. And now, why didn't he include that? I have to, I tremble when I think about it, because for me, you know, he could paint this wonderful dire picture. I mean, it's a wonderful in the sense that it's perfect. I mean, it explains the bad side perfectly. But there's no hope there. He doesn't know that the Lord Jesus Christ is going to win. He didn't know that. He did not know that. And now this is something that I tremble when I contemplate the poor man. And also, I tremble for the people who read the book that don't know Jesus, that don't know that we have some hope. We have hope. We have an excellent hope. You know, if you are an atheist and you pick up this book, it's a very dire and unpleasant picture.
No, you're absolutely right. It's a dire and unpleasant picture. But it is, of course, how are we going to make a better world? And as we look at the world around us, we see all sorts of problems. Well, if you're on the left, you see a corporate elite that is ruling the world. You see the involvement of this same corporate elite in control of both political parties. Chomsky, writes, he's a professor at Harvard, he sees all the problems. It's just that he doesn't see a logical solution. He's opposed to the corporate elite, to the power elite, to America's unseen rulers. But he doesn't know how to deal with it. He wants the government, to give the government power to, of course, take care of these wicked and evil people, without realizing that whenever the government takes power, that power will be misused. The secret of America was that man got their rights from God, and that governments were instituted among men to protect the God-given rights, and that men should be free, not encumbered by government controls. And that's the thing that the Chomskys of this world and the George Orwells of this world never understood. And that is that freedom does not come from government, nor does it come from anarchy. It comes from God. We'll be back in just a moment or two with our special guest this evening, Patrick Murphy. And of course, we'll welcome your calls here at 464-8295-1888-24. Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening, Patrick Murphy, and we're talking about George Orwell and carrying this forward to Winston Smith and the message that he wrote in 1948 and as it applies today. So pick up the story from there, Patrick.
All right. Orwell was a literary critic, and he was predicting basically the future in terms of the impression that media was instilling, this impression that was into the minds of the average individual. He could see how excellent the propaganda was from the ground up. I mean, it wasn't like you had to be in a dictatorship in order to have your mind molded. And he was afraid of it, and he wrote many articles about this. And it was scaring him because he knew how badly things were going.
Well, if he worked for BBC, he would have had to recognize BBC was under the control
Absolutely.
Of this British elite, and they were using propaganda techniques
Absolutely.
To control the British people just exactly as the people who control the media in America today.
Absolutely.
And the Rush Limbaughs and the Bill O'Reillys and the Dan Rathers and Tobin Brokaws
Absolutely.
Are controlling our people here today.
Oh, he understood it so, so deeply. And so when he finally wrote 1984, he was actually including this entire life history it was a dystopia that he could feel that it had already happened. He was concerned. Okay.
Now you're referring to it as a dystopia rather than a utopia.
Exactly.
All right.
So if you look at the book, it opens up with Winston Smith. This guy is being, it's sort of benign. You don't really realize in the beginning of the book that this is a man who, it takes a long time for you to figure out that it's been 7 years that he has had real suspicions about how things are. In other words, he wasn't a dedicated enemy of the system. It's taken 7 years for him to get to this point where he's now willing to defy the system. Because, it's the same with all of us. It takes a long time for you to be willing to say that the what we're being told is a lie.
Well, I think that the hardest thing for the average person out there across America today is to realize that they've been lied to in
right.
their grammar school and in their high school and their college, and the media is lying to them. It's about time. Well, Dr. Stan here, and we're just saying that the average American really find it so difficult to believe that everything that they have been taught in grammar school and high school and college about our form of government, about what freedom is all about what God is all about what society is all about the ruling elite. All of this has been a lie. Right now, though, we've got Jeffrey calling in from New Orleans. New Orleans, is that the way you pronounce it?
Right.
Okay, fine. Do you have a question or comment?
I have a comment to make. Simply put, the reason that Winston Smith could not recognize or understand why he was being brainwashed and why he was being told that two and two could be made to equal what the government wanted it to be is because he didn't have the armament and the background that Ayn Rand would give us in Atlas Shrugged, which was the real answer to 1984. If you've ever read that novel, you would find out that Winston Smith didn't understand that the heart and soul of socialism is sacrifice, the giving of a greater value for a lesser value, and a rejection and denial of man's reason and man's ability to think for himself and use his senses as means of survival.
All right, and certainly Ayn Rand was a very provocative writer, and I would agree with much of what she said, except for her denial of God and the fact that man through his reason was going to be able to create a better society. And I think man through his reasons creating an awful mess of things.
Well, my answer to that is that if that only existence exists, anything outside of existence doesn't exist. And the people who try to tell me that God exists are actually saying that zero that is, nothing is greater than one, and that's absolutely wrong.
Well, of course, you and I will differ on that, Jeffrey. And I will tell you, in the final analysis, it's a matter of faith. And I have all sorts of degrees and Phi Beta Kappa keys and things like that, and I used to believe just about like you do. I no longer believe that way. I have hope. But anyway, do you have a parting thought for us as
yes,
an objectivist?
Yes, I do. My parting thought is this, that faith, which is acceptance without evidence or proof, cannot win because it cannot deal with facts and cannot deal with reality. And for me, I rely on the objectivist system as the one means that allows me as a blind person to be independent and be able to live a normal life, given the handicaps that I've had to encounter and the terrible tortures that I've endured from rehabilitation people, etc.
And, well, Jeffrey, I want you just to keep right on listening to our program. Would you promise me you'll do that? Even though you will not agree with me on the religious aspects of this, I will tell you that the longer I live, the more I'm convinced that God does rule in the affairs of men. And when I see true miracles occur, not in my own life and in the lives of others, when I see the fulfillment of prophecies were made thousands of years ago being played out almost to the word by word today, I find it difficult to believe that God doesn't exist. But then, as one of my good friends said to me one time, Stan, I can't believe anybody intelligent as you would believe in God. And my response to this doctor, a fine doctor, I really have the greatest respect for him, was, I can't understand anybody as intelligent as you can believe that God doesn't exist, because there's a perfect order to the universe. There had to be a creator, and I believe that creator is the Lord that I worship. Anyway, thank you so much for listening and for your comments, Jeffrey.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Okay, fine. That was Jeffrey calling from New Orleans. And anyway, go ahead and pick up the story from there.
All right.
I was going to say, go ahead and pick up the story, Winston. Go ahead and pick up the story.
You know, I love the world that we live in. It's just great. I mean, the America is a wonderful place for the whole range of regions and people and ideas. It's terrific. We have a good place. Okay, so listening to him makes me happy, even though, you know, I would like to. I wish that he believed in Jesus, but okay.
But at least he's listening to our program, and that's all we can do.
That's
maybe,
right. That's
and maybe
glory.
Somehow God will touch his life, but it's going to have to be God, and that's not something that you and I are smart enough to say.
Okay, so Winston Smith wakes up, and he produces in his own heart the willingness to defy the system, and he moves ahead inexorably to this confrontation where he has to do something. Well, it turns out the way the system has been set up in this dystopia is there's Emmanuel Goldstein. Now, this is an imaginary creature, but he's essentially Trotsky, the person who is against Stalinism. Now,
what's his name again?
Emmanuel Goldstein.
No, he's sort of the modern-day Osama bin Laden. He's
right,
that's exactly right.
Yeah.
In fact, Osama bin Laden is designed after Emmanuel Goldstein.
Exactly. No, it's exactly, your doctor said you got it exactly right. This is why our system that we live with today, they're playing us like a harp. It's like a musical instrument. I mean, our heartstrings are being plucked perfectly, exactly as it's described in the book. Okay, so here you have Emmanuel Goldstein. And in those days, it would be Trotsky. The one, you know, because if you think of Stalinism, you know, Trotsky escaped to Mexico and they murdered him. Now, who's going to admire Trotsky? I mean, obviously he's not a good guy either, but he hated, you know, what was being done to this supposedly glorious revolution. I mean, give me a break. But the point is that Goldstein is set up, or Stein, whatever, is set up as this the archetype of evil in the system. And there's this book that once Winston Smith has broken through and declared himself a thought criminal, he admits, I don't agree with the system. I hate Big Brother, and I want to bring him down. And so they give him a book, the so-called Brotherhood. They give him a book. It's supposedly written by Emmanuel Goldstein. So, in the book, it describes this. It says this. Now, this is very important. I think that this is important for everybody, and this is one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you about this subject, because what the book says is that there are three, all throughout all of human history, there have always been three groups: the high, the middle, and the low. And the high is maybe 1%, and the middle is maybe 2 or 3%, and the rest is the rest. So, okay, let's be generous and say that the bottom, the low is 85%. This is, and so Winston Smith is reading this book, and he's reading it, you know, and so it's describing what the world is like. Now, what Orwell is saying in the book in 1984 is that this is true. Okay, we have to, before I even describe it, we have to admit that it's not necessarily true. But, okay, so given that caveat, let's go ahead. Okay, the top, okay, this 1%, whoever detects its existence, I mean, you know, we can talk about Cecil Rhodes, who controlled the entire southern section of Africa, all of the mineral wealth. I mean, how can we comprehend this kind of vast control, this astounding power? You know, these people are impossible for the average listener to a radio program to even understand. I mean, it's just so ethereal. It's so beyond. Okay, the middle, now we could deal with that. Say we're 5%. These are the people that are lawyers, doctors, you know, TV producers, Ted Koppel, you know, people like this. Most of the people that are interested in a radio program like this, that's the middle. Okay, then there's the vast majority of people that can be controlled. They can be herded like cattle. So the book that Winston Smith is given to read says that throughout history, the middle, the small section, has always conspired to overthrow the high, the top, this tiny little controlling group. And so it's been a constant process of flipping, of the middle overthrowing the top, and then they become the top, and then the middle, the new middle. And so what Emmanuel Goldstein's book says, they figured out a way to stop history. That's what 1984 is about, is they figured out a way to stop history so that the flipping will never go on anymore, that the top remains, this ethereal little chunk of, that it will never be overthrown.
Yeah, and of course, this is O'Brien. O'Brien represents Big Brother, represents the ruling oligarchy, represents the people who are like the Council on Foreign Relations and the Bilderbergers and the Trilateral Commission today, who work in conjunction with the communists, who work in conjunction with the Masons and with all the other secret societies for their common goal. But you can't let the people understand that they're really being controlled. You have to believe that they have to believe that they're actually thinking these things on their own, and that 2 and 2 really is 5, and when they tell them something that is patently ridiculous, they'll believe it, like, oh, the magic bullet that killed President Kennedy, or the magic passports that drifted down from the flaming inferno of the World Trade System, identifying one of the hijackers. The chances that would happen would be probably 1 in 100 trillion, and yet the American people have accepted it.
I love it. You know, when Arlen Specter was brought on the radio, I was listening to NPR. Arlen Specter, Mr. Magic Bullet himself, was the one that they brought on to talk about the 9/11 commission. I mean, it was like two bookends. In the beginning, they were going to put Henry Kissinger in charge of the commission, and at the very end, they had Arlen Specter snap his seal of approval on the 9/11 commission. I could hardly believe it. I mean, it's funny. I mean, it's tragic. It's funny, only in black humor, like whistling past the graveyard. Well, anyway, okay, Emmanuel Goldstein's book tells this story. Now, I believe that Orwell was saying, because he didn't believe in God, I think he honestly felt like they had succeeded. Because the book, Goldstein's book says, history has been ended. They won. The top have figured out a way to seal in stone the end of this flipping process. The middle will never overtake the top again. And so I think that he was really, because his experience at the BBC, the propaganda success of the modern media, I think he had lost hope. I mean, I'm afraid that he really didn't have any hope anymore.
Well, because now he was it was immediately after the Second World War, then he went off. Where was he when he wrote 1984?
He was in Scotland.
He was one of the Scots Isles, wasn't it?
Yeah. He had
tuberculosis.
Tuberculosis, and he couldn't have access to the drugs that could have cured him. And he never came to America. He never visited America. And if he had come, and he didn't like America, he had something against us, and if he had come, he would have been able to have access to the drugs that might have cured him. He actually did go to North Africa hoping that this would climate change or whatever would have helped him, but no, it was tuberculosis that killed him, and he was desperately ill as he was writing this book. But I think that he had a sense of desperation that he wanted to get this message out. I honestly feel like he was really honestly trying to tell us something. It was a warning. I don't feel like he was our enemy. I think he was an honest man telling. I think that a lifetime of defying the British Empire and defying, you know, the left hates him, which is interesting to me.
Well, they may very well hate him, but the question is, you know, where did he get the knowledge that he did? Because he had access to the secret knowledge of exactly what the plan was. And, of course, there is a spiritual force behind everything that's going on today that has this secret knowledge, and they know exactly what's happening. If you read the occult literature, they will tell you exactly what's happening. They will tell you that the crown jewel in their plan is the United Nations. They will tell you that there is the senior brothers, the ancients of wisdom, that are guiding us into this new world order, this one world religion that is coming about, and they will even name the people who are involved in key positions that were pushing us in that direction, like, of course, Mikhail Gorbachev, one of their favorites. So why would the occultists like Mikhail Gorbachev? Why, very simply, he is one of the leaders of this whole move to create the New World Order. But how then would how would George Orwell know so many things about what the master plan would be, half a century later? How would he recognize the fact that we were going to have the shortening of phrases, and so we would have something like the CIO instead of the Congress of International Organizations, or, of course, that probably antedated that, but he pointed out that this was going to happen for everything, and it really does happen today.
Doctor said, I would never gainsay or even, I would never question your instincts, because your instincts, especially along these lines, are perfect. Nevertheless, I have no idea.
Yeah. Well, I have no idea. Other than ideas come from someplace, and I know you hear people on the who are involved with occultism and writing music tell that they will come up with these wonderful rhythms and wonderful melodies and of course wonderful words, and they don't know where they come from. I believe that sometimes the people on the right, ministers, are helped preparing their sermons by the force that guides them, just as the force of evil guides other people. So it may very well be that somehow, for some way, George Orwell, he's very ill, he's living literally alone in a cold, damp cabin on one of the Scotch Isles, and he gets these wonderful ideas, almost a premonition of what lies ahead.
I've just read a biography, and it's clear. Please forgive me. I mean, I don't mean to gainsay you. I honestly trust your instincts wonderfully, but my it's true that these themes were building over his entire career. His suspicion of empire when he was shooting elephants in Burma and suppressing the natives, and when he was watching the Stalinists take over the supposedly glorious situation, the hopefulness that the left had in Spain, and then watching the propaganda machinery of not just the BBC in wartime England in the Second World War, but also just the whole propaganda mentality of the media, you know, the American cultural juggernaut. He, over time, was developing a real insight into how this thing was working. So it's possible. No, I'm not going to gainsay you. I'm not going to, you know. Still, I will temper what you're saying with the possibility that he was developing a genuine insight, a godly insight. I hope to see him in heaven. I'm telling you, I'm hoping, I'm hopeful that he's a good guy. In any event.
And you may be right. We will never know until we do get to heaven what the answers are to so many of the things that we face here today. And, you know, but he had tremendous insight. It came from one side or the other. I don't know which side it came from.
I'm hoping that God gave it to him.
I hope he did, too, because certainly God can even use people who don't believe in him. And I think his book, as you say, is
a
warning for today.
It's an absolute warning for today. And here's the real point, and that's the real reason I contacted you to try and... Because I wanted you to encourage your listeners to redouble their efforts to... You know, a lot of people say, oh, yeah, I should reread 1984. Yeah, all right, yeah. There's a lot of books I want to reread. But I want people to redouble their efforts to read this book because I find it to be... I will say that I felt like I got a brand new insight into this book, and it has to do with doublethink. Okay, listen to anybody talk today in the public press, and then listen to Dr. Stan's radio program repeatedly. Listen to and what is the disjunction? It's a complete disjunction. There's no connection between the two. Okay, why? The question is why. Well, we train ourselves in doublethink. And in the book, it explains it really wonderfully well. I mean, pretty much the whole book is a description of how you practice doublethink, which is, okay, mercury fillings. Okay, I read the newspaper every day, and I listen to the news, and I... Every day there's talk about mercury in fish and in the power plants spewing mercury into the air and how terrible this is, and we're just in terrible trouble. Never will they tell us that dentists are putting mercury in our teeth. And that, you know, never will they say that if you drink coffee, mercury is like a thermometer. It expands. So if you have mercury in your teeth, it's going to vaporize, and you're breathing it in. They're terrified of mercury, but they'll never... Okay, why? If they say that, then they get in big trouble. That's the answer. The answer is they get in big trouble, so they can never say it, even if they know it. So this is doublethink. They're unable to... They know a thing is a fact. Okay, how about TWA 800? Or how about the Oklahoma City bombing? Or even 9/11? But how about the men we left behind? Who in their right mind, if you were a politician, would talk about the men we left behind? I mean, their career would be ended. So that even if they know, they could read the book.
Well, we're going to be back in just a few minutes. Our guest this evening is Patrick Murphy. We're talking about George Orwell's 1984. And we're going to welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when we need to remind our listeners out across America that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and we do hope that many of you will certainly make it a point to seriously consider joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters, which is how we're able to do what we do, and be on the radio someplace in America 5 hours every day, and on the Internet 5 hours every day, and on the shortwave 4 hours every day, and on the satellite 4 hours every day, and hopefully soon to be 5 hours, and of course we'll be progressively expand our network out across America. But we need your help to do what we're doing, so we do hope that many of you will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters. If you would like to know more, give us a call at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. That's 464-8295. And then, of course, we hope many of you will want to get some of the items we carry. If you'd like a free copy of our May-June newsletter, which tells you who Osama bin Laden really was. You think you know Osama bin Laden, alias Emmanuel Goldstein, but you really don't know who Osama bin Laden really is. And you probably have never seriously stopped and asked yourself why, if it is true, that the President of the United States on at least two occasions instructed the intelligence community that they had the right, the permission, the authorization to use lethal force against Osama bin Laden. Why did the intelligence community time after time after time after time after time refuse to try to take him out when they had so many opportunities, but they never did? And so the question is why. There has to be a logical explanation for everything. We may come up with the wrong explanation, but there has to be a logical explanation. And our job is to search for the truth. If you'd like a copy of my May-June newsletter, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like to get our July newsletter, which tells you what really happened on the morning of September 11th, and, of course, tells you about the smoking gun that is in the staff report of the 9/11 Commission, and you know nobody in the media ever mentioned it? Do you know that nobody on the commission ever mentioned it after the testimony was given? Totally blacked out in the final report. You ask yourself why, and I would like to suggest that the 9/11 Commission was convened not to reveal the truth, but to conceal the truth from the American people, to give you the feeling that something is going to be done and things are going to be better in the future. Just trust the government. And it's another example of doublethink. If you think about it, you know we're not getting the truth. And yet they managed to really hornswoggle so many Americans with this latest report. It's sold out. They've got the new printing in. But, you know, if you read it, you're not going to get the facts. In fact, if you want to really find out what happened, we can give you some books that will really give you the information. Dave Von Kleist's new video, the pictures, you know, you're either going to have to believe your lying eyes or believe what the government says, because they're totally incompatible. So right now, of course, we just ask you to remember we're involved in a spiritual battle being played out at a political and ideological and cultural and, yes, even on a foreign battlefield. So please remember our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927, and then pray for America. Pray for our leaders. Pray for our troops over there in this impossible situation. And, of course, we ask you to pray for the upcoming election, that the American people may understand that we have two political parties, both go in the same direction, and it's about time the American people realize it's all a charade. And then, of course, lastly, please pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until, well, we're going to have to say goodbye to our listeners up in the Great Northwest. We hope they're listening. We're having some satellite problems. But until Monday, this is Dr. Stan saying goodnight, and may the Lord be with you. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. That's 464-8295. Give us a call. We'd love to hear from you. We're talking this evening with Patrick Murphy. We're talking about the book 1984. George Orwell, what motivated him to write the book? What was his frame of mind when he was telling us exactly what the future held? This plan for consolidating the world into three blocks, and that, of course, if you read the writings of the Council on Foreign Relations, they will tell you that's their plan. Now, of course, remember that Orwell was probably working with people from the Royal Institute over there in England back in the years leading up to the Second World War. The Royal Institute for International Affairs was formed back in 1921. At the same time, the Council on Foreign Relations was formed in the United States. The Royal Institute for International Affairs was formed in Great Britain, there at a place called Chatham House. And, of course, this was the elite of England who were working towards the same goal as the elite in America, the New World Order, the New World Religion. Their plan was three major blocks eventually would be merged together into this world government, and they were certainly planning on using wars and conflicts and all sorts of things to pursue their goal, always concealing the truth from the people that they ruled. And of course, they in England, they had the centers, Tavistock Center, learning how to control the minds of the people with propaganda, and certainly with the control of the media such as they have in England, they were able to essentially control what the British people thought, just as here in America they've been able to pretty well control what most Americans think. In fact, I think it's amazing that as many Americans as there really are question what's going on. We do have, I think, a growing number of people who realize that there really is a serious problem, that we're not getting the truth in the controlled media, that Rush Limbaugh is the finest conservative that money could buy. He's not there to reveal the truth, but to conceal the truth from the American people. And I hate to say this, I think he's a wonderful entertainer, but he's not a man of integrity. So, with that as a background, let's get back to Patrick. And we're talking about, of course, this idea of doublethink. And you remember that there was the ministry, I think it was of truth, and that was a propaganda ministry, and they had three slogans. One of them, I remember, was war is peace. Another was freedom is slavery. What was the third slogan, do you remember?
Oh, now you're forcing me to open up the book.
All right, well, I think the other thing, but the whole idea was that through war, we would be able
Ignorance is strength.
Ignorance is strength, right. And I thought that the part about...
It's so true, isn't it? Right. This is exactly what they've done to us. It's terrible.
Well, could you explain to our listeners how you could have these paradoxes, that they could be true, at least as far as the people who lived in this dystopia, as you describe it?
Well, it's exactly what we have today. I mean, this is the chilling and dangerous reality, is we go on blithely assuming that everything is just fine. I mean, our culture is exactly as he described it, except it's not so cripplingly drab. That's the only difference. So we will listen to anything that is given to us, and we will deny the truth if it's given to you. Like, you know, the 9/11, for instance. Okay, here's a great example. Those buildings came down in 8 seconds. Now, the 9/11 Commission didn't talk about this. They didn't ask the question, how is that possible? That's free fall. The buildings had to... There's no way that the bowling... The way they described it... Okay. No one that I have mentioned this to wants to hear it. I say, okay, how could the building come down in 8 seconds? This is impossible. There's something else going on here.
Well,
this is terrifying. This is crippling to the mind of the person that you're talking to. They close down and they will not go on.
Well, then the thing to do is not talk to them about the North and South Tower. Ask them about Building 7.
That's an even better one.
How
Absolutely.
Could you possibly explain that Building 7 came down? In fact, the man who owned the buildings, and in fact, this wonderful new video that Dave Van Cleese has, and he actually has this film clip of the man who owned the World Trade Center. I've forgotten what his name was, but he's saying, well, they told me they were going to pull Building 7. And, of course, they got all the firefighters out of the building, and then they pulled the building, meaning they pulled it down. And then you see it coming down.
Careful.
Explosives around the base, and they brought the building down. Now, do you ordinarily, when you're going to take a building down, it takes weeks of preparation. You got to get the explosives in there. You got to get them all timed to go at the same time. How could they possibly have all the explosives there within an hour or two of the evening of 9/11? They had to have advanced knowledge. They had to have advanced planning to take down Building 7. This was a classic, takedown of a building, just like you'd see in Reno when they're taking out a hotel.
Right.
So how did that happen, and how did they get the explosives in there in the midst of all the other things that were happening and have all the plans in place if they did not have foreknowledge of what was going to happen? All you have to do is ask the question, and then let other people think about it.
Well, I'm in a total accord with you. The fact is that, but what is the response of the individual that you bring this up to? Because I bring up Building 7, and it's terrifying. Now, there's something that happens in the mind of the listener, and when you talk about Cecil Rhodes and all the rest of it, they always do something like this. They always say, well, I can't believe there's a conspiracy. So I learned something. I finally figured it out. I'm old enough that I finally figured something out. That these people, the average individual that you're introducing these ideas to, they live doublethink. Doublethink has suffused our culture. It's penetrated like fog in the air that gets everywhere. And so here's what it is. People do not have any real ability to detect what has been done to them, thought-wise. They just can't detect it. And so, in a way, Orwell's vision has come true in the worst way. I mean, ignorance is strength? Well, yeah, I mean, it sounds crazy, but people are proud of their ignorance. If you try to express to them the truth, they feel like they become weak. They feel like they become unpatriotic.
You're absolutely right, and I think that's what it is. And the idea that freedom is slavery, the only way that you can be free in this society is to give up any semblance of your own will. Be totally submissive to the authority, and then you can be free within the confines that they allow you. War is peace. Why? Because the only way we will have a peaceful society is when, of course, the world is at war and everybody comes under the control of the rulers. And, of course, it's Plato, and you've heard me use that quotation over and over again, but Plato wrote that when the tyrant has defeated the enemy by treaty or by conquest and there is nothing to fear, then he's always going around stirring up another war so the people will need a leader. And that's what it's all about. And so you always have a war going, or you always have an external threat, it be communism or something else. And then, of course, the people rally behind the government. And that's how you have peace within the society. Otherwise, people would be agitating about what's going on. Well, we've got Ed calling from Michigan. Hi, Ed. How are you doing?
Great. Say, on Free Speech TV, I saw that the satellite dish network presentation, a documentary on, I think it was overt mind control. And the thrust of it is that any highly esteemed, respected authority figure who says A is B and B is D, etc., can dupe the American sheeple into whatever desired outcome they wish. So, during the inaugural speech, Junior Luciferian Secret Society Bush made the statement, if not at the very end, it's near the very end, there's still an angel in the whirlwind directing the storm. So I just wanted to add that to the mix, and the fact that there were cutter charges. The buildings not only came down quickly, but they came down uniformly. And the charges were, as is the case with Oklahoma City, there were internal charges, C4 or whatever, that were strategically placed.
The Have you read Eric Hufschmidt's book?
Pardon me?
Have you read Eric Hufschmidt's book?
No, I have
questions?
Not.
Well, Ed, you may very well be right. I mean, there's some people believe, and I think that's Joel Skousen's belief, that actually they cut there were charges down in the sub-basement that actually cut the major supports of the buildings, and because they found molten steel down the sub-basement, and it was because the supports simply were gone that the whole thing came down. I don't know what happened, and I think you may be right, you may be absolutely right, but this is not something we can tell people because they are not prepared to accept it. Whether it's true or not, they're not prepared to accept it. That's why we're better to talk about Building 7 and ask that question. Or I think that the new video that Dave Van Kleist has, is you actually see this with your eyes. It's a very, very powerful video.
Indeed. Well, the other thing I'd like to mention, speaking of the 9/11 Commission, which egregiously and intentionally subversively failed to identify the location or the existence of the black boxes, which I think, Dr. Stan, you mentioned are designed to be totally indestructible, nor did they mention the fact that the military jets were ordered to stand down because there are incrementally increasing alerts from FAA in the case of hijacking. So they were told to stand down for an hour and a half, and then some jet from some probably a CIA base shot out of the sky with a missile the jet over Pennsylvania, because the debris field was something like 13 miles.
But you see, you can't prove that. We can conjecture, and you may be entirely right, that's exactly what happened. And many people who saw the plane, saw the explosion on board the plane before it plunged down. But, you see, if you can't prove it, all you can do, as I often do, is I say, well, now, we don't know what happened. There's some people who thought it was shot down. But, you know, what the most amazing thing is, there was a second passport that survived the Pennsylvania the crash, and that's covered in the staff report, the staff statement number one. You can get it on the Internet, 911 Commission, staff statement number one, first page. And then I point out, what are the chances that that could happen by accident? Because if it didn't happen by accident, it meant that somebody knew who the hijacker was, who was supposed to be on the plane or was on the plane, and forged their passport ahead of time and then planted it at the field. And obviously, if somebody did that, then there has to be a conspiracy. What are the chances that two passports, one survived the flaming inferno at the North Tower, the other survived the flaming inferno there in Pennsylvania, and if that plane really did, it crashed down out of the sky, nose first, and a massive fireball there on the ground, how did that passport survive? And so you stick with what you can prove rather than what we conjecture. Otherwise, they'll turn you off. But if you ask those questions, at least they're forced to think. Ed, the most important thing is to get people to think. They're not going to believe you if you tell them. Try to get them to begin to think, because you've got to break this veneer that controls their thought process.
I would add this. What you're saying is a way to sort of penetrate the doublethink.
Right.
Right.
I mean, this is a technique of penetrating the doublethink. But how can we get around this self-reinforcing system? I mean, which is what doublethink is. In 1984, if you fail to master doublethink, it's called a thought crime. There's the thought police that will catch you, and eventually you will be brainwashed.
I think they call that the new freedom. That's the new Bush program, to have mental health programs for every individual in America, and to put those who are mentally ill onto medication. And this is not imaginary. This is the plan.
Dr. Stan, they're doing that with the school kids, aren't they?
They're doing it with the school kids, but they're going to do it with you, too, before long. They got a great new census questionnaire for every American with all sorts of things that have nothing to do with the census, and it's a federal crime if you don't answer it accurately.
Well, in fact, Dr. Stan, I think there's some provision in some executive order that in a time of crisis, there's supposed to be forced vaccinations, and anyone who refuses, I guess that's part of the public health initiative.
That's the Model Emergency Health Powers Act, right?
Okay. But one last thing that I'd like to mention here, that I like to bring to people's attention, is the fact that everyone believes it's patriotic to pay income taxes, and how else could we be the greatest country on earth, blah, blah. And so I say, okay, FedRes, that's part of the federal government, right? Well, then look it up in the in the government section of the phone book under U.S. government, and see if you can't be hired in under civil service. And while you're at it, ask your U.S. representative and senator for the last year's audit report and as many of the previous year's audit reports of the Federal Reserve. Well, obviously it can't be done, right?
Right.
So I don't know how else to bring it home to people other than to say, okay, so you believe you're a taxpayer. So then tell me, since you are a taxpayer and you're parting with your hard-earned money, what is the legally binding criteria for taxpayer status?
Well, I think I agree with you. You're absolutely right. But, you know, I think the simplest thing to get through to people, and it's got to be simple, Ed, and that is, you know, we're not a democracy, a republic. How do they convince an entire nation of a lie? And that, if you can get them to begin to understand the difference between a republican and democracy and that they're all lying, at that point, the lights begin to go on. Hopefully, they're going to begin to think, hey, thanks so much for calling. We got to get to Roger before the break.
Thank you, Dr. Stan.
Bye-bye, and thanks for calling. And let's go to Roger. Hi, Roger. How are you doing?
Yeah, hi, Jack. You guys are talking, and I'm thinking, there is, of course, not explicit alternative to the some conspiracy theory, and that is the universal ineptitude, stupidity, and malfeasance theory. You know, they never call it that, though, do they?
I don't think they're inept. I think they know exactly what they're doing. I think there's a master plan. It is to create a world government and a new world religion.
Yeah, and I've been kind of saving up a question for, say, some of your high-profile establishment media conservatives. At the risk of giving away the farm, here it is. Could you please describe to us how, given that we have perhaps 1,000 or more books purporting to document an Illuminati One World or Burger agenda, would you please suggest the one or two non-existent titles that purport to debunk that agenda?
Oh, I'll give you an excellent one, and that's that is, of course, Dan Brown's book, Da Vinci Code, but the first book that he came out with, Angels and Demons. Although it's a novel, it certainly debunks the whole idea of the Illuminati. And I'll tell you, it's a fascinating book, and you read it, and if you don't know your facts, he will lead you off right off the end of the gangplank.
Well, that would be an odd book to go to for, given its fruitcake spirituality mixed in with it.
Well, anyway, we're going to have to take a break. You want to hang on, Roger?
Please.
Oh. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and of course our guest this evening is Patrick Murphy, and we've been talking about George Orwell's concept of 1984 and this idea of doublethink, which Orwell described, and yet it is, of course, widespread today. They can convince us of almost anything. It doesn't matter how illogical it is. They can convince us it's true. And what they do is, of course, they will talk about two issues, like the Wall Street Journal has one position and the New York Times has the other. And of course, the Wall Street Journal says deficits don't count. You don't have to worry about the federal deficits or the federal balance of payments. These things are all showing the strength of our society. And then you got the New York Times that, takes exactly the opposite position. But neither side is really telling the whole truth, that this whole thing is planned. It is an effort, of course, to destroy the infrastructure of our society, and that the people who control both the Wall Street Journal on the right and the New York Times on the left both come from that little club of elitists known as the Council on Foreign Relations, which was formed back in 1921 as a front for Cecil Rhodes secret society. And to verify what I'm saying, let me suggest pages 951 and 952 of Professor Kara Quigley's book, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time. And Professor Quigley is best known as being Bill Clinton's mentor, but certainly if you read Samuel Huntington's writing, and he's a professor there at Harvard, and he lauds Professor Quigley as one of the great minds of modern times. But Roger, did you have another question for us?
Yeah, well, I meant to lead off with my question, describe how it is intellectually robust to dismiss, or how it is done to dismiss a priori, that agenda, in other words, that's what is done. And since it is so patently ridiculous, then why is it that like about 9 out of 10 of Rust Limpjaw's conspiracy coup test questions have to be misstated from a conspiracy view person? I mean, if they're ridiculous on the face of it, why do they have to be misstated?
You know, I find that this to be astonishing, because I've listened to the program routinely, and I'm amazed that he gets away with it. I'm astounded that he gets away with it. Here's my explanation. I mean, this is the way I describe it. It is a system of thought that is being, we're being trained. This is doublethink. In 1984, if you are inside the system, you can succeed. And you know, there are people who say, well, doublethink means believing two contradictory things at the same time. This is not true. Whenever you read this, this is a mistake. This is not what the book says. What it is you know the truth, and you suppress it and believe the lie. And if you believe both at the same time, you are a thought criminal, because eventually you're going to have to come to grips with it. And so what Rush Limbaugh is doing is he's training us how to not believe the truth, to suppress it entirely and go ahead with the fake world that is being presented to us. I mean, I've spoken too vociferously. I don't mean to. I mean, I want to give you a chance to speak back. But this is how I describe it.
All right, fine. Then we're going to have to just bring our other stations back on board here, and then we'll let Roger make his comments, and then I'll tell you what I think. Well, go ahead, Roger. Do you have a parting thought for us this evening?
Yeah, well, you were mentioning Rush Limbaugh, and I think it's interesting. You know, he used to be interesting like about 8 years ago under that paradigm of the times, but anymore you can tune in and you know exactly what he's going to say before he says it. He never stretches one's understanding of anything or deviates from that really repetitious strain that he's been parroting.
Okay, well, I think that, you know, I think at one time Rush was a good conservative, pro-American individual, and then I think that he compromised his position for power and for money, and you know, it's amazing how God works. I mean, Rush has terrible problems. He's fabulously wealthy, and now he's getting a divorce. His wife will probably get half of what he has. He's certainly been embarrassed by bringing out the fact that he's been taking drugs. He's compromised everything he believed in for power and sex and money, and of course he's just a shell of a man today. He's brilliant, but he didn't stand on principle. And whenever you compromise your principles for personal advantage, why, you're laying yourself open for terrible, terrible consequences. So anything else you'd like to say before we let you go, Roger?
I say it isn't so, and God bless you all.
Okay, fine. And our guest this evening is Patrick Murphy. You know, as I remember reading the book 1984, and at one point after O'Brien has taken Winston in, he's captured him, he's torturing him, and he explains to him what socialism is. He said socialism is a boot stamping on a human face forever. Do you remember that?
Absolutely.
And, of course, then he holds up two fingers, and he says, "You see three fingers." And O'Brien looks at them, Winston Smith looks at the two fingers, and he stares at them, and he says, "Yes, I see the three fingers there." And he really does see them. This is the frightening thing, that they have destroyed his mind. And then, of course, he's always had this terrible resentment, this hatred of Big Brother, because he represents everything that's wrong and evil and vile in the world, and it's just deprived him of his ability to think and his integrity, and then they've taken away Julie, his girlfriend, the one woman he loves. But in the end of the book, why, of course, Winston Smith is watching the crowd running down the street shouting, "They love Big Brother, they love Big Brother."
Actually, it's he himself, it's Winston Smith that says, "I love Big Brother."
Right, he does. There at the end, they describe a silver bullet coming into his brain.
And he is a person who has been successfully remade in the image of the society. And this is the terrible hopelessness of Orwell. This is where I feel a terrible tragedy exists in this thing, because there's nothing in that book about the hopefulness of religion.
Absolutely, no hope. It's a story that without hope or without any redemption at all.
No, it's a terrible thing. You know, Dr. Stan, if we have a few minutes left, I could tell you why I reread the book. I've reread it over the years since my college years, or before that, since I was a teenager, and I read Don Richardson's latest book, Secrets of the Quran, and he has two major books that are his sources. And one is by a guy named Ibn Warraq, which is called Why I Am Not a Muslim. And I had read that book. And I said, this is pretty good. His other book that is his second major source material for his book, and everybody should read this book, Secrets of the Quran. I mean, everybody should read it. But anyway, the other book is by a person named Bat-Yor, B-A-T-Y, it's a hard to pronounce spell name, I could look at my shelf.
It doesn't really matter, just go ahead.
Islam and Timothy, it's Y-E apostrophe O-R. It's Islam and Dimitude. Dimitude is, anybody who lives in Islam, under Islam, is a dhimmi. That's not a Muslim. It's a D-H-I-M-M-I. Okay, so I'm reading this book, and it's a terrifying reality. This is the entire history of Islam. If you're a Christian or a Jew living in an Islamic country, it's horrifying. So I was thinking to myself, and what she's saying is that the whole West, America, Europe, everywhere, we're all systematically accepting Dimitude. We're all accepting Islam as a legitimate religion. And it's like a spider web that's being systematically, woven over us, and we're being brought...
I think you just hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment with Patrick Murphy. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Patrick Murphy, who's certainly one of our loyal supporters. And we're talking this evening about George Orwell's 1984 and this idea of doublethink, this idea that war is peace and freedom is slavery and ignorance is strength. Those are the slogans on the Ministry of Truth, which was the propaganda arm of Big Brother's society. And then, of course, Patrick is taking us one step further and saying, you know, we're being propagandized today about the very nature of Islam, that you know, there is no such thing as freedom under Islam. You are certainly, as a Muslim, you're totally subservient to the state, to the theocracy, but then as a Christian or Jew living there, why, you are a second-class citizen who has to pay special taxes, who has no true rights or freedoms. And yet, of course, he's trying to draw the analogy between that existence under Islam and what's going on in America today. Would that be a correct assumption?
Well, the reason I brought it up is because this is what drew me to reread 1984. As I read Bat Yor's book, Islam and Dimitude, I realized that there's something about our acceptance of Islam. I don't know why. I don't know how America, or the West in general, but specifically America, has just accepted this idea that Islam, you know, you read the paper or you listen to the politicians talk, and they'll now include the mosque when they say church and synagogue and mosque. They will include it as if it's just as natural as apple pie. It's just as normal can be to include Islam along with Christianity and Judaism. And I said to myself, okay, I'm reading her book, and she's describing what dimitude is, what it means to be a dhimmi, to be this, to accept Islam as the normalcy. And I said to myself, something is going on in our culture, and it reminds me of 1984. And I haven't read the book in 6 or 7 years, which I've read it over the years, every 6 or 7 years. I must have read the book 5 times now in my life. Well, finally I reread it. I was ready to reread it because I said there's something about what has happened to our culture. How is it that we have accepted Islam, which is such a catastrophic mistake to accept it? How is it that it has become so normal? And I said this, there might be something about doublethink. There might be something going on here. Well, then when I reread 1984, I found that there was a lot more going on, and I got much more information out of
that. Hold that thought. Okay, Dr. Stan back here. Our guest this evening is Patrick Murphy. He's talking about how, after reading 1984, he's suddenly able to better to understand why it is that the American people are accepting the Muslim faith as simply another religion, along with Christianity and Judaism and the various sects of Christianity, because, of course, the Muslim faith is a terrible faith. It is totally oppressive, both to the Muslim and, of course, to the Christian or Jew who lives under this faith. There is no freedom for anybody there. Women are second-class citizens. You get out of line, they chop off your hands, they chop off your feet, they chop off your head. They do that in Saudi Arabia, which we're funding today. When we wanted to condition our minds against the Taliban, why we had articles day after day in the media and pictures day after day on television, how terrible the Taliban were, and of course the beheadings and the floggings and the stonings and the burqas, and yet the same sort of thing goes on. In Saudi Arabia, they don't have burqas for the women, but they have to keep their face covered, and of course they flay them, they flog them publicly. If they're caught in adultery, that's if they're lucky, otherwise they stone them to death, and they castrate the males, and they chop off the heads and feet in Chop Chop Square in Riyadh every single week. When was the last time you saw that on television in America? And you don't, because, after all, the Sauds are our good allies, aren't they? And, well, why is it that one is our enemy and the other is the ally, and they're both just as corrupt? In fact, I think in many ways, the Saudis are far more corrupt because they don't even believe in what they're doing. They're simply using religion to advance their own great wealth. They're hundreds of billions of dollars they have salted away, in bank accounts in Switzerland, while many of their people live in abject poverty. So pick up the story there.
Well, what's tremendously, astonishingly ironic is our country was founded, and I always say that America, the only reason we are here is because Henry VIII wanted a divorce. And it's about the English Reformation. I mean, America was founded because the Puritans came here. Well, the Puritans have a terrible reputation, and they talk about, you know, the witch burnings. Maybe like, I don't know, less than 20 people were killed in witch burnings. In Saudi Arabia, it happens every day. And the thing is, here, the idea that our founders, the people that founded America, the people that came here because they believed in founding a Christian nation or Christian civilization, it's terrifying to me that we have lost track of the truth, and we are willing about our own roots, and we are willing to just accept blindly, just blindly, just completely without any kind of second thought, this alien horrible religion as being equivalent and equal, and giving them. I'm telling you, I was so worried as I was reading Bat Yor's book. I said, there's something wrong. How is it that we have been mystified, that we have been, it's like, I think of it like a spider that hypnotizes the fly before it wraps it up in its silk.
And, of course, we are the fly, I assume.
Right, yeah.
All right, well, I think, Patrick, you have to understand that there is a conspiracy against God. Now, if you look at it from a completely objective point of view, the administration's doing everything they can to convince us that, we all worship the same God, the Muslims, the Christians, and the Jews. The president has said that. The president has invited leading Muslim clerics to the White House. They've invited them to the National Cathedral to give opening prayers. Why? They worship a different God. And I'm sure the people in Washington, D.C. really know that this is a satanic God, but many of these people actually embrace Satanism themselves. The Muslim religion is satanic, and if you need documentation on that, you'll need to get the wonderful book written by Craig Wynne, which we do carry, called The Prophet of Doom, and he's simply taken from the Hadith and the Quran and the three or four other major writings of the Muslim faith, all written within 200 years of Muhammad's life, the references to Satanism and demonism. And if you read what Muhammad said about his religion, about what the other people, his followers, said, it is obviously satanic. So that's why they don't want to criticize that, because we have people who do worship the same God in Washington, D.C., but it's not the God that you and I worship.
Well, I just read Craig Wynne's book, Prophet of Doom, and I cannot endorse it more highly than you just did, but I will give it exactly the same endorsement. It's astonishing.
Well, I think that the appendix is worth the whole book. It's a hard book to read, but the appendix is worth the whole cost of the book.
You know, Dr. Stan, when I was reading Bat Yor's book, and it drove me back to 1984, it really caused me to feel that if American thinkers, people who are thoughtful individuals, which is your audience, if they don't go ahead, and 1984 is a very easy to read book. I mean, it's not pleasant based on the subject matter, but it's easy to read. It's not a hard book to read. If they don't, okay, take time, go ahead. I know you've been saying, talking to the audience right now, you've been saying, oh, yeah, I should reread it. It's been a long time. I'll read it again. Everyone should reread it. Go ahead and do it, because if you don't do it, you're missing out on something very important. It's a great tool to understand what is being done to us. I feel tremendous urgency in this. The importance of this cannot be overstated.
I agree with you totally. I think that we have to get people to start to think, to realize that we've been brainwashed, they're playing games with our minds. But once you can begin to convince other people of that, at that point you can begin to break the grip on their minds and on their hearts and on their souls. That's what it's all about. This is a battle for the souls of men.
I agree. The fact is that we have a real problem, and that is that we've accepted a thought process. And you know, Rush Limbaugh is so successful. I hate to beat up on the guy. I mean, and what you mentioned earlier is true. It's the poor guy has, you know, made some mistakes, and he's reaping the whirlwind. But all the people that are being trained in how to think, this is the problem, is how to think, how to separate truth, what they think is truth, from wackoism, as Rush would call it. Well, all right, this is a dangerous situation. We need to remember that there is a God on the throne in heaven, and he's not defined by what the establishment tells us. There's something terrifying about this, that the people are willing... Okay, you know, Dr. Stan, over the years you've really brought us back to the roots of the thing. And Cecil Rhodes is a good one, but the Illuminati and all the rest of them when you go to that direction, the one that you always anchor everything in, this is what they're telling us not to pay attention to. This is what the double thinkers, or training in doublethink, is telling us not to focus on. And this is why I think if we read 1984, if we think about it from this perspective, we will it's an additional tool so that we'll feel comfortable not believing the lie.
And I think you're absolutely right, Patrick. But the one thing I would caution people, in the end, of course, why Winston Smith is running down the street with the rest of the crowd, and of course he's shouting about how he loves Big Brother. And that's the end result of facing what's going on today if you don't have a relationship with the Lord, because there is no hope. If you read the writings of H.G. Wells, his last book, you have this sense of it's all hopeless. And certainly Orwell was a man without hope. Well, you and I do have hope, because we know that there is a Lord, and no matter what happens, whether we get through what lies ahead, or whether we may be destroyed and have terrible times, or face torture or extermination, but we know that we have the hope that Orwell and H.G. Wells and Bertrand Russell and George Bernard Shaw, none of the other people did have, because of course we know there is a Lord. That God does rule in the affairs of men. He's allowing these things to happen. Right now, though, we've got Richard calling from Florida. Hi, Richard. Do you have a question or comment?
I have a comment, Dr. Stan. We've all heard of Pavlov's dog experiment, of how when Pavlov would ring a bell, he would feed the dog and he conditioned the dog, and the dog would salivate every single time he would ring the bell. But that's only half of the Pavlov experiment. The half that they don't tell us in the book, in the history books, is that after Pavlov conditioned the dog to salivate after he rang the bell, he would then, the second part of the experiment, he would beat up the dog severely, and then he conditioned the dog to train to accept that after he would ring the bell, the dog would panic. So then he started feeding the dog again, and the dog would go into a catatonic state. And I believe that's what they do. I mean, we can't understand why there's so much apathy, but see, all this double, you know, like telling, oh, there's terror coming, and then, oh, but then from the other side of the mouth, they say, well, but go to have fun in Disneyland, you know?
Yeah, they're playing games with our mind. You're absolutely right. We saw that with the assassination of President Kennedy, and then immediately the assassination of Oswald, you know, and it was just blow after blow after blow, and they were all aimed at the minds and hearts of our people. Yeah, they know exactly how to manipulate us, and they're manipulating us today. And that, if you go back and you look at the films that were taken on September 11th, and you pretty soon, very shortly after the initial attack, suddenly there's music in the background and tear-stained faces and people covered with dust, and then the music in the background, and suddenly it's like a great production. And then on a Saturday of that night, that week, where there was Willie Brown, what was his name, the pop singer. Anyway, he's singing America the Beautiful over and over and over and over again. And they have all the Hollywood stars there for this great extravaganza, you know, celebrating our patriotism. And I'm watching this and I'm saying, they're manipulating the American people. Willie Nelson singing America. He had verses of America that nobody else has sung for years. And of course, all to get this tremendous patriotic response, and everybody's waving a flag, and nobody's asking the question, how did this possibly happen when we have the ability to watch people from space, to read a newspaper from outer space, you know, where we monitor every telephone call and every email and every fax, and we had our agents infiltrated into Al-Qaeda, and the Mossad had their agents infiltrated into Al-Qaeda, and all the intelligence agencies of the world were monitoring this and telling us the attack was coming. And our leaders say, gee, shucks, we had no idea this was going to happen. You know they're lying.
Yeah.
But our job is just to try to get people to think and not to make outlandish statements that we can't back up, make statements that we can back up and put them in the form of questions. There's nothing more powerful than a question. And, of course, you're trying to get people to think. So, Richard, that's our job, is to try to get people to ask the questions.
Well, Dr. Stan, it's been years since I read 1984, but also I remember reading that how the proles would get obsessed about playing the lottery. And, I mean, so it was apparently all this lottery is already was pre-planned from a long time ago.
You're absolutely right. Every time I see that, and I wonder why. You're the first person who's mentioned that, but you're absolutely right. The lottery is simply a diversion for the proles, you and I, fellow prole.
You know, Orwell is so clear on this, that the 85% are whatever, you know, that's a general figure, but it's the vast majority, are easily controlled, easily manipulated by their desires, by their base instincts. And the normal people that are the sort of the professional class, I don't even know what words to use to describe the upper middle or whatever we call ourselves, We're the ones who design it and structure it and create this world that the proles have to endure. And we'll never see those overlords above us, and so we think that it's a good thing. You know, I'm not saying individually. I'm saying that our class, we're the ones who program the computers that make the lottery work.
You're absolutely right. What we have to do is get people to understand the games that they're playing. Our producer just put up on the board, you know, that we express our ideas in words. If they can take the meanings of words away from us, they can change their meaning. How do we express ourselves? For instance, what is the meaning of right and left? At one time, of course, the left were the liberals. They were the people who wanted individual freedom. They wanted to restrict the power of the king, of the government. And today, the left is the people who want to increase the power of the government. You know, the people on the right originally were the people who supported the king. And now they are supposedly, at least theoretically, are in favor of limiting the power of government. They just change and alter everything. The word even the conservative. What is a conservative? Well, he's one who wants to conserve what we have today. I don't want to conserve what we have today, because what we have today is a form of fascism.
So I agree.
What they do is they take the words away from us, and how do we communicate? And the truth of the matter is they don't want us to be able to communicate intelligently. They want us arguing over left, right, conservative, liberal, Republican, Democrat, and we spend all of our time talking about nonsensical things without understanding the real nature of the battle we're in, which, as you know, is a spiritual battle for the souls of men. There's a conspiracy. It's a conspiracy against God. And, of course, everything else is a manifestation of that. Richard, do you have anything else you want to say?
Well, to add to that is how in 1984, every time there was a new edition of Newspeak, the words would change. And eventually, and so far in the future, the new speak, the new language would be perfected. I remember that.
I agree with, I'm glad that you brought that up because we haven't discussed new speak. I mean, we've touched on it tangentially, but you're right. I mean, we see this all around us. I mean, the control of language, I mean, we call today political correctness, but it restricts the domain of thought. This was Orwell predicted it, that the language would be controlled so that you can't think certain ideas. If you think outside of, and it was formalized in the book, Newspeak, but if you think outside of the box, out of the realm of acceptable thought, then you declare yourself to be a thought criminal and you'll be caught and you'll be destroyed. This is what the book tells us. And this is what we see increasingly. But here's the beauty part. I mean, it's ugly, but I mean, the beauty of Orwell's vision is Newspeak is a way to create a successful doublethink. If you want to be a double thinker, if you want not to be destroyed because you're a thought criminal, then Newspeak is a godsend. It's wonderful for you because it enables you to do double think without effort. You can not really, I mean, the idea is if you think the, in today's terms, political correct thoughts, you can escape from thought criminal behavior. I mean, you're able not to even think bad thoughts. This is a terrible thing. They're successfully, or he successfully described a world where you'll think the way the system defines it, the what's good.
I think George Bush said it best. He said, "You're either with us or against us. You're either with us or with the terrorists." And that's the two choices today.
Right.
And if you don't go along with this,
right,
you are a terrorist. Hey, Richard, we're going to have to let you go. We got Will calling from Missouri. Anything else you want to say before we let you go?
That's it. God bless.
God bless you, too. And let's go to Will from Missouri. Hi, Will.
Hello, Dr. Stan. All night long I've been listening now, and we've missed one set of words that it has historic and legal implications, and I'll just give it to you. It's a definition out of the Black's Law Dictionary. I introduced this once before on another broadcast, but the term is, and this is a legal term, it's voluntary ignorance, which means a willful obliviousness, an unknowing or an unaware state resulting from the neglect to take reasonable steps to acquire important knowledge.
Well, it's like the idea that we're going to have voluntary service, a compulsory voluntary service. But you're right, they play games with our minds, and pretty soon we can't even figure out what we're talking about.
And we have no eloquence left, or rhetoric, or oratorical skills. And so, if one would just ask oneself, am I falling into voluntary ignorance? I know there's a lot to this issue. Well, I think I'll just look into it. And if we would do that a little bit more, we wouldn't turn our back when someone hands you a tape or a tabloid or a book and say, please read this, you know. And we get that from our House of Representatives, we get it from the senators, from our local judges and our sheriffs. And if we all just remember the term voluntary ignorance and try and avoid it in our lives, I think we would be able to solve much of this problem.
I think you're absolutely right. Go ahead there, Patrick.
If we trained ourselves to think about Blackstone, you know, if our culture were to reclaim Blackstone.
Oh, what a blessing, and then go back to Lord Coke, and we'll really be on track.
Well, just a little bit would help.
Let's change the whole society, so let's get people studying the Institute of the Constitution's material. It's great. It's built based upon our Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, but it's also based upon Blackstone. Hey, we're out of time. Well, thanks so much for calling. God bless. And Patrick, do you have a parting thought? We're going to have to let you go in just a moment.
I am so grateful just to be able to spend a little time I thank everybody for listening. I really encourage everyone to go ahead and reread, or for the first time read, 1984, because I believe it has tremendous significance.
I agree with you totally, and I believe it is truly prophetic. Now, where Orwell got his ideas, I don't know whether he got them from the bad side, whether he got them from the good side, but I do believe that this is really beyond the scope of one man's imagination. I believe that there's a message here for posterity, and I believe it can be used as a message for good and for the preservation of the freedom, which I think that Orwell professed and believed in, but never understood. Because, of course, freedom is not the ability to do what you want to. As the left winger would have us believe, freedom is the ability to do what you should do according to God's word and God's law. Because you remove God's law, you wind up with moral anarchy. Thank you so much for being with us, Patrick. It's been a fascinating time.
Dr. Stan, I appreciate you more than I can express.
God bless you.
Bye.
Okay, fine. Well, that was Patrick Murphy, who's certainly back there in Indiana, one of our good and loyal supporters. And so, anyway, I hope you enjoyed the program. A little different, but I think it's important that we reclaim this knowledge that many of us had before. And I believe Patrick's absolutely right. The message that you'll find in 1984 is a message that we should read and restudy and then help to utilize and help to get those ideas to others. Remember, your job is to tell others about what's going on, and they may ignore what you say. Don't get discouraged. The whole idea is that you tell them, if God intends for them to believe or listen, they will. You're not going to force them to. Maybe it'll be somebody else who will come along and harvest the product of the seed that you sold. But doesn't really matter. We're not in this for notches on a belt. We're here to try to save as many souls as we can, to point people in the right direction, to try to save America, but even more than that, to try to bring people back to our Lord, because this truly is a spiritual battle being fought on a political and ideological battlefield. And Patrick Murphy, I appreciate so much being with us tonight. For our listeners out there, let me remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and if you believe in what we're doing, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like a free copy of our newsletter, our May June newsletter tells you who Osama bin Laden really was. Again, the number 1-800-544-8927. If you haven't read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, let me recommend it to you. And it's a great book to give away, first of all. It's not that expensive, but even more than that, it's simple and easy to read, and you never give a book away. You lend it to somebody and tell them you want it back again. The same thing with a video or an audio tape, and we have the same story on video and audio tape. It's the story of the Brotherhood of Darkness, but it's really the story of the secret societies that are states that stretch back through time, back thousands of years. And, of course, they've always had a goal, a new world order, a new world religion. And our job is to make people understand that behind everything going on today is this eternal spiritual battle between God and Satan that is being fought out on the ideological and cultural and battlefields of the world today. Yes, it's being fought out over in Iraq today. It's a battle for the hearts and souls of mankind, not just Americans, but people throughout the world. So pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for our leaders and ministers, but please remember to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection, until Monday when we'll be back again. May the Lord be with you.